Our third case for this morning is Mora de Lusta v. City of Chicago, 11-22-61. Mr. Gentleman.
Yes, Your Honor.
I actually have a technical question to ask you. Is your client's name Elusta, or is there an R in there somewhere?
Moran Elusta.
Elusta. But he was involved in earlier litigation before this court.
Correct. I believe other lawyers appealed the judgment. He got a jury verdict in his favor, and there was appeals related to whether or not he would that should be affirmed.
Right. The name was spelled differently, but if you want us to spell it this way, then this is how we'll spell it.
I believe I have it the correct way. Yes, Your Honor.
I defer to your expertise. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Today we're here on an appeal asking for this Court to reverse a finding of the trial court related to attorney's fees. The division of attorney's fees awarded pursuant to 1988 that were awarded after my client won a 1983 case. And the case that we cited here is a Supreme Court case, Venegas, that establishes essentially that when you're dividing up the fees and the award in a 1983 case, you look at the fee agreement, and you can and you figure out how the monies are going to be divided. In Venegas, the attorney drafted a very thorough fee agreement saying that he controlled the fee case, the 1988 fee case, that if there was a recovery in the 1988 fee case, that he would recover 100% of the fees plus the contingency on any verdict that was awarded. So that's the basis that these cases should be looked at. Now we look at the...
I have a real problem with your fundamental premise, which is that attorney's fees are part of the, quote, judgment under your retainer agreement. Normally, when you talk about a judgment, you talk about something that either a jury or the court sitting as a trier of fact says, you know, the judgment is for X dollars, you know, some number. I'll just pick a number out of the air and say $50,000. And that's the judgment. And then we put the judgment over here and we say, well, A is the party who won the judgment entitled to costs. Okay, you decide that. B, maybe there's an attorney's fee statute like 1988 or something else. And you decide if there are attorney's fees. But the attorney's fees are not part of the judgment. The attorney's fees are an ancillary matter.
No, I believe that they are part of the judgment.
But why? I mean, they never are. And so why under your agreement are they?
Well, I think that, well, because here the part of the cost, 1988 says part of the cost recoverable in a case could be the attorney's fees.
So well, that's true in every case. Attorney's fees conceptually, with one exception, which is if somebody gives a Rule 68 offer of judgment for global settlement, that might include both the attorney's fees portion and the judgment portion. But you're not in the Rule 68 land. You just got a judgment, and it was a judgment for $40,000, and then you asked for your 1988 fees. But I have never seen a case that treated fees under a retainer agreement like this one the way you're proposing to do it.
Well, if you look at the – usually I've litigated these cases before, and I think Venegas separates these
– Venegas is not a case that helps you in this respect.
I think it does because it usually when you're dealing with 1988 fee cases – The fee case is owned by the client, not the lawyers.
It says you look at the agreement, and your agreement doesn't do what you say it does. Of course, and this, fees go to the client, and the client then has to pay the lawyer, and sometimes people aren't sure that's going to happen, so they may make the check out to both or whatever. There are all sorts of things that happen. But
I'm not sure what the fee agreement does say about it.
If the client doesn't pay the lawyer, then the lawyer has to sue the client in a collection action.
I suppose if the check was written directly to the client, right? If someone wrote the check directly to the client, they cashed it and didn't pay the lawyer, then of course, yeah, then they would be subject to liability. Then they'd be subject to liability.
I can't get from this agreement to this somewhat bizarre use of the term judgment that you're suggesting.
And I don't think we have to, Your Honor. I think we have to look at the agreement itself. I mean, is the agreement clear and unambiguous and tell you that the lawyer is going to get 100% of the attorney fees that may be awarded plus a percentage of the verdict that is awarded in the case, like in Venegas?
Well, it does say that the lawyer gets 40% of the gross amount recovered by judgment or settlement, and then in a separate part says that the client acknowledges that the attorneys will divide the attorney's fees recovered.
Seems
pretty clear.
I think, and that's a different section. Usually, you know, because, and I think this last section of the agreement, which we're discussing right now, because of the fact that another lawyer was brought into the case that wasn't part of the fee agreement. Generally, in fee agreements, what you do is you identify the other lawyer and the fact that it's not going to cost the client any additional monies. So I think that's what that clause is dealing with. It's not really entirely clear saying, where does it say in this agreement, 1983, 1988, attorney's fees that may be recoverable, they get 100% of them. I think
it doesn't have to. What Venegas says is look at the agreement. The agreement specifies who gets the amount recovered by settlement or judgment, and then the agreement separately deals with attorney's fees and talks about who's going to get the attorney's fees. Why isn't that pretty clear?
I don't think, I think I'm out of time here at this point, Your Honor.
Well, you're in your rebuttal time. It's up to you, but.
I'll deal with it now then, your question, because the fact. The way I look at it is Venegas the fee agreement's done 100% accurate, how it should be done. Now, this agreement is nowhere near that, so the question then becomes, is this good enough? And I understand that Your Honors are saying at this point, maybe this agreement is good enough to do the same thing that Venegas did. And I'm saying, no, it's not, because it's ambiguous. I mean, maybe this last paragraph states that the attorneys get 100% of the attorney's fees awarded, or maybe it says that they split whatever the percentage is, they split 50-50. It could be either or, and the point is, if it's ambiguous, the agreement was drafted by a lawyer, it was drafted by him, there's evidence in this case interpreting that the bottom of this agreement, at least to my client, what he was explained, meant that the lawyers were splitting the percentage, whatever they received, not that they were going to get 100% of the attorney's fees awarded under 1988. So that's the question here, if this agreement is ambiguous in any manner, it should be construed against the lawyers. And I believe it's ambiguous because it's nowhere near Venegas.
Okay. So you can save the rest of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, ma'am.
We have a lot of people on the other side. Who do we have first? Are you Mr. Smith?
I am, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the panel. Zane Smith on behalf of Zane Smith and Associates and Sheila Benson. I believe the threshold question for the panel is the determination of whether or not the appeal is timely. As you know, one of our responses in this appeal is the fact that we believe the appeal that was filed by Mr. Alusta is untimely, since the final judgment in this case was entered in October of 2008. And the time to file an appeal should have begun, or the clock, if you will, should have started then. We have made several arguments in our support of our position. As the panel correctly noted, the judgment in this case is not the attorney's fees, but in fact the judgment that was entered after the jury verdict by Judge Kaur.
But he does seem to be talking about the attorney's fees, and that order awarding fees was December 13, 2010. There's a timely motion for essentially reconsideration on the 23rd, denied May 4th, notice of appeal June 2. So that all sounds
right. The question for the panel is, did Mr. Alusta have an obligation to file an appeal on the attorney's fees when the issue, his argument is, the issue wasn't ripe until there had been a ruling? In other words, there wasn't an issue to appeal until the court had entered an order on the attorney's fees. The problem with that is that the attorney's fees and the question of the allocation of the attorney's fees between Mr. Alusta and the firm was one that was brought up very early, shortly thereafter of the judgment in October, as a matter of fact.
But it hadn't been resolved by the court until the December 13 order.
This is true.
Seems to me a little unfair to ask him to file an appeal on something that hadn't been resolved, and we probably would have rejected it.
Well, if he's going to bring the appeal under the section that he brings it under, that section requires that the appeal be brought within 30 days of the date of judgment. The date of judgment was October. But I understand the panel's reluctance. But
So maybe you should just address the merits briefly, because there's not much time.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the issue is the determination by the panel of what the intent of the parties were. You have to look at all four corners of the retainer agreement. The retainer agreement actually addresses the separate issues of judgment and attorney's fees, as stated by Your Honor a moment ago, the first part of the retainer agreement refers to the percentage of a judgment that was entered either by settlement or verdict. In this case, we have a judgment by verdict. And the issue of attorney's fees is addressed in the bottom part of the retainer. Mr. Alusta, in his appeal, likes to cherry-pick and only refer to and talk about the 40% and repeatedly refers to the 40-60% split, when, in fact, the panel must take into consideration, as Judge St. Eve did, as to the entire agreement. And the entire agreement between the parties does adequately address the issues of what to do about the judgment and what to do about the attorney's fees.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Serta?
May it please the Court. Judge Wood, to answer your initial question with regard to the name of Murad Alusta, Murad Alusta is also the fellow named Murad Alustra in an appeal before this court where he accused Judge Mason of entering into a settlement agreement
without authorization,
which is the same thing he accused me of doing. And
So he is the same person? And
he's the same guy, made the same arguments, and it would have failed in the district court had myself and John De Leon realized that the minor daughter had turned 18. We would have been able to enforce the settlement agreement then, and we apologize to this court, Judge St. Eve and Judge Kaur for causing this continued litigation. The question that is presented on my appeal and that of Mr. De Leon is whether the court awarded us quantum merit or statutory attorney's fees, and it's patently clear that we were awarded quantum merit so that Mr. Alusta was not enriched by our legal services. The issue seems to be straightforward. The issue of jurisdiction was also addressed by Judge Kaur at the outset, where he found that the court had supplemental jurisdiction to entertain the issue of whether we, to what extent we would be compensated for our legal services.
I'm confused about that jurisdiction. You and Mr. De Leon are out of the case for a significant period of time, over a year, and then only came back in with the quantum merit claim after the judgment was entered. So how is that something that's so related to the 1983 action that it's part of the same case or controversy?
Because we were still, the issue of attorney's fees was still being litigated at that point. And
but
one
this
of
isn't
our,
attorney's fees.
Well,
this,
one
is,
of our,
this is unjust enrichment for work done a long time ago.
One of our arguments was that pursuant to the contingency fee contract, which wherein we did actually, the third paragraph from the bottom, serve Mr. Alusta with notice of the attorney's lien, we were entitled to either quantum merit or an hourly rate or be compensated for money in an hourly
but
rate.
You didn't join the petition for attorney's fees.
We couldn't join the petition for attorney's fees because we didn't have standing to do that. They belonged to the plaintiff, but pursuant to the contingency fee agreement, we were entitled to be compensated by the client at an hourly rate.
I can't understand why that is not a state law dispute between you and your client that is not within the jurisdiction of the court. I know it relates to this case. The work was done on this case, but I just have difficulty understanding how that comes within the court. Now, if, for example, if Mr. Alusta wanted to sue you for malpractice, he could bring that in that 1983 action?
That would be I think a separate issue, Your Honor. I think this issue
how
has
is,
to do
how
with
how is that any more separate than the quantum merit claim is?
Because it has to do with the issue of how we were to be compensated by Mr. Alusta, whether it be via the
if that issue were part of the attorney's fee petition, I would understand it. I'm having difficulty with the quantum merit part of it.
Because the district court, if it it's addressing how many hours we're supposed to be compensated for pursuant to the contingency fee agreement, the district court would have then had to decide how many hours were reasonably compensated, how many were reasonably performed for Mr. Alusta. And my time is up, and we ask that the district court's decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Luce. The process of the elimination from the city, I assume.
Yes. Good morning. May it please the court. In response to the question that was raised about jurisdiction, very briefly, I'll make a couple of points on that. We believe that the court did have supplemental jurisdiction. There are, of course, two requirements for that the court has original jurisdiction over a federal claim, and that was the Section 1988 fees claim that was pending. And the state claim is the state quantum merit claim was also part of the same controversy. And I believe the claims are so related to be part of the same case or controversy because it did involve analyzing many of the same facts. They're two different.
Would you agree then if Mr. Alusta thought that De Leon and Serta did a poor job, that he could sue for malpractice as a claim against them in the 1983 action?
I do not believe that that would necessarily involve the same case or controversy as. But in this case,
how is it a different case or controversy from the quantum merit? It seems to me to be very similar. Well,
perhaps an argument can be made, but the reason why I believe the two fees claims are the same is because the court would be analyzing whether or not the fees were reasonable in both circumstances, looking at things like the nature of the case, customary fees awarded for similar type of litigation.
That really benefit conferred on Mr. Alusta from that original work that then passed along to the second group of lawyers. So, I mean, I can see the overlap. I guess the question is always how much is necessary for jurisdiction.
Sure. If this court decides there is not jurisdiction, then, of course, that claim should be dismissed. But, of course, that's all. Our main position here is that the city should not be liable for the fees that were awarded to Mr. Serta and Mr. De Leon in any event. To address the merits of the claims that the city should be liable for those fees if the court did have jurisdiction over that claim, we just want to make clear our position that Mr. Lusa cannot pass off his liability for fees he would owe under that state law claim to Mr. Serta and Mr. De Leon based on a Section 1988 claim to fees that he never pursued. He chose not to include Mr. Serta or Mr. De Leon in his fee petition and even opposed Mr. Serta and De Leon's motion for briefing under Section 1988. He said it came too late and that he did not wish to represent whether those fees were legitimate. Mr. Alusta, for the first time, argues that he should now be allowed to amend his fee petition. That comes for the first time in reply, and it is waived. But even if he had raised it in the district court, when Mr. Serta and Mr. De Leon came in to court seeking fees, it was far too late. As this court held in Robinson, a plaintiff seeking to bring a fees petition or to supplement a fees petition so late needs to have a good reason to justifying why they're doing so belatedly. And Mr. Alusta has presented no good reason or any reason at all justifying his delay. The district court should not be burdened with a whole new supplemental petition under these circumstances. If there are no further questions, we do ask that the district court's judgment that the city is not liable to pay any attorney's fees Mr. Alusta owes Mr. Serta and Mr. De Leon in quantum merit be affirmed. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Gentleman?
First of all, Your Honor, I have no idea about those other cases, nothing to do with them. I don't know about Mr. Alusta.
Don't worry about that.
Okay,
I just
want that clear. With the jurisdictional issue, I don't think we want to open up the floodgates for every lawyer who's been fired to come back into a case and then have a summary proceeding on his attorney's fees. So it's sort of like the divorce court in the state of Illinois where they allow that kind of thing by statute. So I don't think there's any jurisdiction with respect to the quantum merit claim. Now, I do believe that Mr. Alusta, I think we discussed the...
You're conceding that there's no jurisdiction over the
quantum... Regarding the quantum merit, I think there's jurisdiction...
In other words, you're conceding that Mr. Alusta just has to pay... the $15,000.
No. I don't think the district court had the authority to enter that judgment because it was a quantum merit judgment with no jurisdiction. What I'm saying is that the fee petition is Alusta's fee petition. It was timely filed within 30 days by Smith and Jensen. Therefore, there's not a lack of jurisdiction. Now, there's later on, there's an amendment to that fee petition by Serta and De Leon. Now, I think we should consider that as an amendment to the original petition because jurisdiction was was there is jurisdiction because it is Mr. Alusta's fee petition. I think the fair and equitable thing here to do is Mr. Cerda and DeLeon did work in this case. Mr. Alusta was successful in this case. The city of Chicago was found guilty of some heinous acts in this case. So really, shouldn't Mr.
Civil liability.
Civil liability of you know, and we won't get into the actual, and I'm sorry I'm speaking fast, but I'm trying to get all this in before the last second. So I think the just and equitable thing would be to compensate DeLeon by the city of Chicago because they did.
The city points out that there was never a 1988 petition.
They're what? They're originally,
they covered them.
Well, if they do, I have the quote in the brief where DeLeon does ask for that in his initial pleading that was filed. It was late, but there was an initial timely filed petition.
And Mr. Alusta opposed it, right?
I don't know. There was nothing in the record saying I oppose or I object or I refuse to allow you to file it. Obviously, there was a problem between the lawyer and the client because there was a termination or withdrawal from the case. So, but the point is, shouldn't all the lawyers in the case be compensated by the city of Chicago here because the plaintiff was successful in this case? Now, I know it was a little bit untimely, but jurisdiction still was attached to this claim.
I'm having trouble following you, though. I mean, it seems like you're both saying that there's no authority to adjudicate anything with respect to Mr. Cerda and his part, Cerda and DeLeon, and yet there is authority. So which?
Well, there is no authority for Cerda to get a common law judgment against Alusta here in this case. There is authority for the city of Chicago to have to pay for the legal services that Alusta used with Cerda and DeLeon in the case because he filed a fee petition in the case within 30 days of the judgment.
Okay.
If there's any other questions, then I would ask that.
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much. Thanks to all counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.